Welcome, everybody. Thank you for coming. And thank you, Cynthia, for hosting me tonight. We are going to discuss liberation through resting at ease in whatever happens. And this is based on a song by the great Lama Shabkar. I thought we could start by all just chanting this song together, and then I will say a few words about it, and then we can open it up for discussion or questions if there are any. Does everybody have a copy? I've entitled this "How Amazing." That's not, it doesn't actually have a title, but that's the theme. Okay, so let's begin. Amaho, I, the untroubled and carefree renunciate, will now sing the song about the view, entitled "Flight of the Garuda." It enables one to swiftly traverse all the levels and paths. Listen carefully, fortunate children of my heart. In both samsara and nirvana, the renown of the awakened state is heard everywhere, like thunder throughout the sky. This awakened state is always within the minds of all beings. How amazing that one is never separate from it, even for an instant. Not knowing that the awakened state is within oneself, how amazing that one searches for it elsewhere. Although it is as clearly manifest as the brilliance of the sun, how amazing that so few see it. Having no father and mother, one's mind is the true Buddha. How amazing that it was never born, so never dies. No matter how much happiness and sorrow is experienced, how amazing that it is never impaired or improved, even in the slightest. How amazing that the mind's nature is primordially pure, unborn and spontaneously present. How amazing that this primordially free self-knowing nature is liberated just by resting at ease in whatever happens. Thank you. So this is really the first song of a work known as Flight of the Garuda, written by Lama Shabkar. His name is also Tsokdruk Rangdrol, which means self-liberated sixth sense perceptions. He was a Lama who was born in eastern Tibet in the Amdo region in the late 1700s, lived to the mid-1800s. And he was renowned as a great composer of dohas, or spontaneous songs of realization. He is known to some as the second Milarepa. Like Milarepa, a great yogi who lived some hundreds of years earlier, he sang and composed many spontaneous songs of liberation. His songs are known for their simplicity and their directness. And in his songs, he really transmits the essence of what is called Dzogchen. Dzogchen means literally the great completion or the great perfection. And it's considered the highest teaching in Tibetan Buddhism. I think one reason it is considered so high is because on a certain level it is so simple. And that reminds me of what the Buddha said after his enlightenment under the Bodhi tree in Bodh Gaya about 2,500 years ago. His first thought was, what I've discovered is so simple and profound that I don't think anyone will understand it. Sometimes it's the most simple and obvious things that are the most difficult to understand, because they're right before your face all the time, but you just haven't noticed it. So in Dzogchen, awakening is really like that. This song comes from a collection called Flight of the Garuda, and the name refers to a mythical bird named the Garuda. And the quality of the Garuda is like the quality of our own Buddha nature, in that, according to myth, the Garuda is born, hatches full-grown from its egg. As soon as it hatches, it's capable of flying across the entire universe in just a few flaps of its wings. So the Garuda can encompass vast space in a moment. And that really points to the nature of our own mind, our own consciousness, our own awakened mind. Sometimes in Tibetan Buddhism, they talk about the youthful vase body. It's like a Buddha in a vase that's within you. The Buddha is fully developed, fully grown, completely enlightened, but he's concealed in a vase. So it's like having your lamp in a bushel or something like that. Although that metaphor is a little misleading, because really what's being spoken about is not concealed in any way. It's like an open secret. It's concealed in broad daylight, so to speak. I guess I should say a few words about Dzogchen. Dzogchen has a few names. It's called Ati Yoga sometimes. Ati refers to the primordial quality of intrinsic awakened mind. Primordial meaning not so much that it was formed a long time ago, as that it is beyond time. It's fully present, not subject to time. It's always been present, always will be present. Dzogchen itself means the great completion. And in Sanskrit, it's also sometimes referred to as Mahasandhi. Mahasandhi means the great joining or the great union. So you Sanskrit scholars out here might know that Sandhi is actually used in Sanskrit as it's a set of rules when you join compound words, how that works. So Sandhi just means joining or union. Shabkar was, as he says here, was a renunciate. He spent most of his life wandering around Tibet, living in retreat, living in the mountains. And he spent some time studying with Dzogchen masters, but also in a Gelugpa monastery. But most of his life he wandered around and just taught spontaneously. This particular text that this particular song is from, The Flight of the Garuda, contains 23 songs. And they're widely read, and almost as a practice. Some people will just read them or chant them as a practice because they're so inspiring. they deal with a particular teaching in Dzogchen called Trekcha. And Trekcha means cutting through. Or sometimes it means breaking through. And what's being cut through really is the false conception of who we think we are to the true realization, experiential understanding of who we really are. Trekcha also can be thought of as cutting the bonds of a bundle or a sheaf of twigs, something like that. So when you cut those bonds, then the sheaf just flops and is loose. So there's a quality in these teachings of being loose in a certain way, not being sloppy, but being relaxed and being open and being simple and ordinary in a sense. So really, in a certain way, Trekcha not only cuts through our false conceptions of who we are, but it really cuts through all our false conceptions of what spirituality is. Because many people, when they think of spirituality, they think of imposing rules on themselves, and they think of attaining very high blissful states of mind, or going to other realms of existence, or what have you. There's so many ideas about spirituality, and people, all of you from the North Bay, have, I'm sure, been exposed to some of the more interesting ones. But in Dzogchen, spirituality is very simple, and it's about really being who you are and knowing who you are in a simple but profound way. I should say also by way of introduction that these teachings really deal with what's called the nature of mind. And the nature of mind needs to be distinguished from mind. So mind, when we look at our minds, what do we see? We see thoughts, feelings, perceptions, often a jumble of thoughts, feelings, and perceptions, a continual stream that goes on and on and on, often in irritating circles and cycles, which is really samsara, those cycling, unsatisfactory and unhappy and obsessive circles of thought and feeling that we all tend to get caught up in. But essentially, really, mind is thought, feelings, perceptions, memory. Also part of it is a real big, a very central thought, which is this I thought. Me, I. But that, like other thoughts, comes and goes. Most of the time, you're not thinking I. But it comes with a vengeance from time to time. So that's all mind. But the nature of mind is the underlying awareness or consciousness in which all of those thoughts, feelings, perceptions arise, stay for a while, and cease. So it's the basic kind of knowingness or awareness or consciousness that is, in a sense, the source of mind, the background of mind, and in a certain way, the substance of mind. So we're always focused on mind, we're always focused on our thoughts and feelings and perceptions, but seldom do we notice the consciousness, the self-aware consciousness itself. So really, in Dzogchen, that is what's being pointed to. This is called The Nature of Mind. One translator calls it mindness as opposed to mind. It's kind of an awkward way of putting it, but it's a way of distinguishing mind's intrinsic, essential nature as consciousness from the contents. This basic conscious or knowing quality is also spoken of as Rigpa. And Rigpa is a Tibetan word that is a translation for a Sanskrit term, Vidya. And Vidya in Sanskrit normally just means knowledge. So it can be any form of knowledge can be referred to as a Vidya. If you study Ayurveda, Indian medicine, that's a Vidya. If you are a student of Jyotish, of Indian astrology, that's considered a Vidya. So it can be used in an ordinary sense like that. But here it's used in a kind of extraordinary sense as knowledge or consciousness or the knowing nature of mind itself. Vidya also is connected with the sense of seeing. It is seeing itself. Vidya is, its root is connected to many English words such as vision, video, words that are connected with the sense of seeing. I think Chogyam Trungpa Rinpoche referred to it really as insight, which is a pretty good translation. In a certain way, this whole teaching of Dzogchen and of cutting through of Trekcha is about gaining this knowledge or insight as to what our true nature is, as to the true nature of mind. And it's interesting because what is known is, in a sense, knowing itself. The basic knowing quality of yourself as a conscious being, which is your most essential quality. The thing about this intrinsic knowing quality is that it is self-luminous. They say, really, when they talk about the nature of mind, that it has three aspects to it. One is that it's empty, which means really it has no form and it accommodates everything. You can't really look inside and find the knowing quality as a thing. It's not like there's a little transistor in the center of your brain that you're going to come up with that is what is knowing. There is no thing that's knowing, but there is knowingness itself. It has no form, it has no essence in the sense of being a thing or an object in any way, so it's empty. It's also luminous, which means it has a quality of awareness. It illuminates whatever is happening. Whatever is happening, whatever is being experienced, is illuminated by this nature of mind, this basic consciousness. And it illuminates itself. You don't need another quality of consciousness or another consciousness to know consciousness. You don't need someone to tell you you're conscious either. It's kind of like the metaphor of a candle. The example of a candle illuminates the room and it also illuminates itself. There's a candle in a room that's lit. You don't need to get your flashlight and go looking for the candle. The candle is self-luminous. Your awareness is like that. And the other aspect of it is that it's intrinsically compassionate. So it has a quality of some kind of warmth and ease and accommodation and openness to whatever is happening. Sometimes in Dzogchen, compassion is almost more like a creativity. It's a creative responsiveness that we all have in ourselves to life intrinsically. That gets cramped by our concepts about ourself and others, but it is there intrinsically. In Lama Shabkar's work, The Flight of the Garuda, the emphasis mainly, though, is on the luminous quality of mind, the intrinsic self-awareness. How do you see this luminous quality of mind? Well, the first thing to understand is that the one who's looking to see it is the one that is to be seen. It can't be seen as an object in any way. So when we say luminous, obviously, I should say, we're not talking about some experience of light, a flash of white light, or anything like that. It's just a metaphor for the quality of consciousness which illuminates whatever comes before it or into it. Anam Thubten often talks about turning the eyeballs as if turning the eyeballs inside. So it takes some kind of self-inquiry or self-inquiry and investigation at first. And often if you read through Flight of the Garuda, what he begins is with a kind of analysis where he urges you to actually look and see, can you find the mind? Can you find its intrinsic nature? And again, you can't find it as an object, but you can know it as that which is actually looking. The emphasis is very much on having this view that I'm trying to describe. In Buddhism, we often talk about the view and then the practice. It seems that in many teachings of Buddhism, the emphasis is on practice, doing a lot of meditation, which is good. But in Dzogchen, the emphasis is on first having the view. That's why I'm spending so much time talking about this. Because it's important to have some, at least, glimpse of this intrinsic awareness that's your own nature. And then meditate from the Dzogchen point of view. You know, really the two work together. And they say that meditation without the view is like a blind man walking on the path. The view without meditation is like a lame man who can't walk. Really, though, meditation is primarily, from this perspective, to contemplate what you have seen of your true nature and to assimilate it. So it's important to have the view. The view being some understanding, perhaps intellectually at first, then intuitively, and ultimately experientially, what this intrinsic awareness that we're talking about really is. Okay, I'm going to go through this song. begins Emaho, an expression of awe or amazement. I, the untroubled and carefree renunciate, will now sing the song about the view entitled Flight of the Garuda. It enables one to swiftly traverse all the levels and paths. Listen carefully, fortunate children of my heart. So I've already discussed a little bit about the Garuda and a little bit about the view. And the thing about this kind of approach to awakening is that he says it enables you to swiftly traverse all the paths and levels. In Dzogchen, really the goal is taken as the path. So in a sense, the point is to get some, at least intuitive, and ultimately some very clear and decisive understanding of the view, of what your true nature is as intrinsic awareness. And then you work with that in a certain way. You meditate on that, you contemplate that. If questions and doubts arise, and they almost certainly will, you take them to your teacher, and you raise those questions, and you have them answered. This isn't a matter, by the way, of blind faith. It's a matter of actually seeing it for yourself. And so, when questions arise, it's important to talk about them, to ask someone who you think could help you resolve your questions or your doubts. And when you have some understanding of this, this is really the goal, is knowing this, knowing this view, knowing your true nature as Buddha, as awake and intrinsically aware. And then the path is to assimilate that knowledge, contemplate it, stabilize it, some people say. So in a certain way, rather than a very laborious path of hacking away at our grasping and our neurosis, branch by branch, leaf by leaf, branch by branch, till we finally get to the trunk, and then sawing that laboriously and then digging up the roots, what we do is we go, in a certain way, right to the roots. That's why this teaching is really supposed to enable someone to become awakened in one lifetime. The next paragraph is, in both samsara and nirvana, the renown of the awakened state is heard everywhere like thunder throughout the sky. This awakened state is always within the minds of all beings. How amazing that one is never separate from it for even an instant. In this translation, I've kind of slightly modified a translation by Eric Pema Kunzong Schmidt. That is pretty much out of print, I think. And also looked at a translation by Tony Duff, who is a translator who lives in Nepal, I believe, and looked a little bit at the Tibetan with my minuscule knowledge of Tibetan. So I slightly altered it, but this I pretty much took from Eric Pema Kunzong's translation, which is a very nice poetic translation, but sometimes there's slight, in the interest of poetic flow, there's might be some slight arguable inaccuracies. Really, you know, what it says is the renown of the awakened state. Really, it says the renown of the Buddha is heard everywhere like thunder through the sky. The Buddha is always within the minds of all beings. How amazing that one is never separate from it, even for an instant. So the point here is that we tend to think of the Buddha as an external person, often. And in some teachings, you know, he's viewed as either the historical Buddha, Shakyamuni Gautama, who lived about 2,500 years ago, or as a cosmic Buddha somewhere. The Buddha in the physical form is known to have 32 major and 80 minor marks, including things like Dharma chakras on the soles of his feet. And I was looking at those, I was curious, the other day. Arched, he has to have arched feet, so a person like me has flat feet, I can never be a Buddha, unfortunately. And his skin has a golden glow. He has a little curl in the between his eyes that emits light, and so on and so forth. And I'm not saying that there may not be such an amazing being or have been such an amazing being with those marks. It's possible that over many lifetimes that, you know, we see sometimes extraordinary people who seem to almost by birth just be quite noble and advanced, and that can happen, you know. But that's not really the Buddha that we're talking about here. We're talking about your own Buddha nature. No matter who you are, what you look like, what your problems are, your intrinsic nature is the Buddha, is awakeness, is intrinsic awareness. And that's what's being talked about here. And as he says, you're never separate from it even for an instant. This intrinsic awareness is really the ground of your conscious experience at all times. That's what kind of makes it not easy to recognize on the one hand, and on the other hand, supremely simple and easy to recognize if you can understand that. In other words, whatever you're experiencing, including right now at this very moment, is happening in the space of awareness. That itself, that space of awareness, which really is unborn and unceasing, which has no limits to it, is not bound by time. Time is just another object of awareness, so to speak. Time is the sequential occurrence of events, but the background, the awareness in which those events occur, is itself timeless. So this very awareness that you are experiencing right now, when seen clearly for what it is, as not being bound by the objects of awareness that you are experiencing, is itself the Buddha nature that you're never separate from. The next paragraph goes on, not knowing that the awakened state is within oneself, how amazing that one searches for it elsewhere. Although it is as clearly manifest as the brilliance of the sun, how amazing that so few see it. And really the only reason so few see it is because they're looking for something outside of themselves. They're looking for something outside of this present awareness that they are already experiencing. They think that it is somewhere else, something to be gained, and not something that is completely imminent in every moment of experience, but not bound by any moment of experience. So because of that false belief that it is somewhere outside of themselves, that it's somewhere other than the very ground of their experience that they're having right at that moment, they don't see it. They're just looking in the wrong direction. And Shapgar, who sees this clearly, is amazed that that's the case. Now you have to realize it's not that people are stupid or anything like that. It's not like anybody's doing anything wrong. It's just that it's natural. Our whole minds are devised to be looking outward at object. It's probably hardwired into us as a survival mechanism that we need to be aware to survive of what's going on outside of us. So our attention is always on the objects of experience rather than on the nature of experience itself, the consciousness that illuminates experience. So it's almost reversing the natural trend that's practically hardwired into us, and that's all we kind of have ever been tuned into, to actually look inward at our own consciousness itself. But until someone points this out to you, it would be almost impossible for you to come upon this by yourself, because everything that in you is geared towards using your sense perceptions and your mind to look at the things that seem to be outside of you. So it isn't until someone like Shabkar or the Buddha points to the ground of the awareness itself that you're probably ever going to look there. So what I'm trying to say is, how amazing, but that's not a put-down of anybody, how amazing that people don't see it only because it is so simple and obvious. But it's also quite natural that people wouldn't see it until it's pointed out. Having no father and mother, one's mind is the true Buddha. How amazing that it was never born, so never dies. No matter how much happiness and sorrow is experienced, how amazing that it is never impaired or improved, even in the slightest. Basically, every object that we can see as an object of our experience is born and dies. It has, in a sense, a father and a mother, which means that it is formed by conditions, by causation, by conditionality. Therefore, everything that we experience as an object, our bodies, our thoughts, our minds, other people, your chair, this table, anything is composed, is formed by conditions. At some point, the conditions will change and it will dissolve and cease to be. But what's pointed out here is that the intrinsic awareness itself is not like that. It isn't formed by conditions. It is what is aware of all forms and conditions, but itself has no form, and itself is not created. Since it was never born, it never dies. You know, one way, a simple way, to possibly think about this is, if you think back to your earliest memory, maybe you were 3 or 4 or 5, everything, whatever was happening then, isn't happening now. And the person you were then is not the person you are now. Your body and your mind are completely different. But the fundamental awareness of whatever that was is the same now. There's a sameness to it then and now. The fundamental quality of just being aware doesn't change. In some ways, if you look to see what is it that's always the same, that never changes, then that can be possibly a doorway to understanding this kind of awareness. Is this making sense to people? Okay. No matter how much happiness and sorrow is experienced, how amazing that it is never impaired or improved in the slightest. And you know, as far as this being really liberating, having this kind of insight, in a way, this line really points to that, because then whether one is happy or sad or suffering or having pleasure, the fundamental knowingness of that, the fundamental awareness quality, is not in any way diminished by it. It's kind of like a mirror. A mirror can reflect beauty, or a mirror can reflect ugliness, but the mirror doesn't change. The mirror is still bright and reflective. In the same way, this fundamental awareness is always bright and reflective. When you see that, then you, in a certain way, always have an inner refuge. So that even if your mind is in turmoil, you can stop and connect in a certain way with that fundamental aware quality that is not in turmoil, that isn't changed, that isn't marred by the difficult experience that you're having. And in some ways, in meditation, that's a great opportunity for that, because when we just sit and relax and just open to whatever is happening without picking and choosing, without accepting or rejecting anything, but just staying awake and aware, then you can begin to see that the mind goes through whatever it goes through. It goes through its fantasies, it goes through its replays of difficult things, it goes through plans for the future and memories of the past, and all the rest of it. But they all come and go. The fundamental awareness of that doesn't come and go, and really is not fundamentally affected. So you can find, in a certain way, a refuge or a home for yourself, so that even in the midst of difficult circumstances, you know that fundamentally you are not being impaired, and you are not being diminished by those circumstances. How amazing that the mind's nature is primordially pure, unborn, and spontaneously present. How amazing that this primordially free, self-knowing nature is liberated just by resting at ease in whatever happens. In Dzogchen, this idea, this teaching of primordial purity is really fundamental. In Tibetan, it's called Kadak. And Ka is the first letter in the Tibetan alphabet, and Dak, it means purity. So this means like something like alpha purity, pure from the beginning. Never was impure. So there isn't really any sense of original sin here or anything like that. Originally, you're not screwed up. Originally, you are full and complete conscious being. And that primordial purity is spontaneously present, which means it doesn't have to be created, doesn't have to be manufactured, it doesn't have to be cranked up. In a lot of teachings, in Buddhism, we cultivate awareness, and there's good reasons to cultivate awareness. But the cultivated awareness can help us eventually tune into this awareness, which really is not a cultivated awareness. It is awareness that's intrinsic. In other words, we may guard the mind in some ways, which means we are aware of we become aware or mindful of how our mind is disturbed in various circumstances, so that we can become objective about it. So if we're getting angry, we can see, oh, I'm getting angry, hopefully before we start acting out of the anger and creating even more difficulties for ourselves and other people. So we guard the mind in that way. So we cultivate awareness. We cultivate mindfulness. If we are feeling envy, greed, and so forth, the same thing. We learn to become aware of what is going on in our minds. You know, am I being seized by greed or envy? Hopefully, as you become more mindful, one can become aware of that and moderate one's conduct so that you don't act out of that and create more a chain reaction of anger and greed and envy until it becomes a firmly entrenched habit of anger and greed and envy and so forth. So those practices to cultivate awareness are very important. But those practices really help us to gain a certain tranquility, simplicity, and order in our lives and in dealing with our minds, so that then we're more able to actually connect with, tune into, and see this intrinsic awareness that really need not be cultivated. You see, if you're extremely agitated, it's very difficult to tune into this fundamental awareness, because this fundamental awareness always being there and being all pervasive is kind of subtle. So if you're engaged in extremely gross mental, not to mention physical activities driven by greed, anger, envy, and so on, you are not likely to have the space, so to speak, to even be able to connect with this. It's not that it's not there. In fact, in the midst of greed, anger, and envy, it's completely there. But it's hard for us to see it when we're so engaged in gain and loss and insult and honor and all the other dualities that we are constantly engaged in. So these practices of mindfulness and awareness, of knowing what's really going on with yourself, are important, and learning to moderate that and catch it before things get out of control, these things are important, and learning to engage in virtuous conduct, basically, are important, you know. But ultimately, they're a preparation in a certain way, so that one has the space, the simplicity, and the tranquility of mind, so that this subtle yet at the same time vividly present awareness that need not be manufactured can be seen. How amazing that this primordially free self-knowing nature is liberated just by resting at ease in whatever happens. There's something a little bit funny in this particular sentence. I don't know if it's the translation or if it's just the nature of language. It says it's primordially free and it's liberated just by resting at ease in whatever happens. You see, if it's primordially free, then what does it need? Why does it even need to be liberated? It's already free. It's already liberated. But by seeing that, by knowing that, and then being able to, that gives you the ability to just be at ease and rest in whatever happens. Then, in a sense, you're free. You're freed by resting at ease in whatever happens. So that's the first song of the flight of the Garuda. And in some ways, this song, it gives an outline of the entire work. It gives a taste of the entire subject. And I find it a very beautiful and inspiring one. So that's why I wanted to teach it tonight, talk about it tonight. Sometimes people think that these kinds of teachings are too advanced or something, but I don't think that they're that complicated. It's just that they're so simple and profound that it sometimes is a little hard to see it, to have the confidence in a certain way to actually see that that's your true nature. I had the opportunity to visit Tibet a couple of summers ago, and I met with the head of one of the heads of the of Larangar, which is this wonderful Nyingma monastic college that was established by His Holiness Jigme Punsak Rinpoche in Golok, in a remote region of Tibet. He established it with just a few monks, and then people started to hear about it, and they found a building, this amazing shanty town around it. And then the Chinese came in, and they bulldozed it. But then things loosened up a little bit, and the Chinese started to allow them to rebuild it. And now there's just hillsides covered with little self-constructed monks' homes. And it's quite a vigorous active place of the study of the Dharma. And one of the leaders of it, since His Holiness Jigme Punsak Rinpoche passed away, is a Lama named Toku Tenzin Gyatso. I had the opportunity to meet with him, and I asked him, what do you think is the most essential teaching to give people in the West? And he said, well, to begin with, of course, bodhicitta, which is the aspiration for enlightenment, for the benefit of all sentient beings, and then prajnaparamita, mahamudra, and dzogchen. So that's what he emphasized. Prajnaparamita, the teachings of emptiness. Mahamudra is another nature of mind, essence teaching, which in essence is no different, really, than the Trekcho teaching, these teachings of Dzogchen. So, with that encouragement, I thought I would talk about this with you. So if there are any questions or comments or anything, you're very welcome. Yes?
I think just this simple words, just by resting at ease, and brings up thoughts of who or what is resting at ease. That itself, you know, whether that's cultivated, how complete that is. I don't have an actual question, but that itself is pretty can be pretty evasive during difficult situations. I mean,
yes.
that itself is what makes situations difficult.
Exactly.
You know?
Yeah.
So I know that's the concern in a certain way. That's the open secret, you know, or part of it is how does one know how to rest at ease?
Yeah. Well, that's why it's so important to have this view of knowing that your true nature is this intrinsic awareness that's never diminished or harmed by whatever is happening. And assimilating that, if you have insight into that, assimilating that insight. Still, there will come times, because we're not, most of us are not actually, we have the Buddha within us, but we are not fully developed Buddhas yet. So there will be times of turmoil and difficulty. But if you know what your true nature is, then you can, when you see that your mind is getting out of control like that, in a lot of turmoil, you can notice that, which is where mindfulness comes in, and you can stop and connect, if you can.
What do you think of the idea of resting at ease being experiences of threat?
Resting at ease as being a threat?
Yeah.
What do you mean by that?
We're pulled in different ways.
I mean,
we could be pulled.
Exactly, yeah. Okay, I think I know what you're
saying.
Well, that's, you know, it all comes down again to understanding the view, you know, because what is the, you know, a threat to what? And another text that I'm teaching now in San Anselmo on Tuesdays, the aspiration prayer of Samantabhadra, it says something about knowing this, then you have no fear, even if the three worlds were to be destroyed. But that can only happen if you really understand that your nature is not conditioned by circumstances. It's unborn and unceasing. I'm not talking about having an eternal soul. We don't believe in that as Buddhists. But there is a primordial or timeless quality to awareness that isn't subject to the threat, no matter what's happening. You're a human being. If suddenly a Mack truck is bearing down on you that you hadn't noticed while you're crossing the road, your heart's going to beat hard, and you're going to breathe hard, and you're going to jump out of the way if you can. That's okay. I'm not talking about that kind of instinctual fear. You need that to live. But I'm saying this fundamental sense of fear, which comes from the duality of believing in the reality of me versus the world, can be resolved through really understanding this view. So, you know, it's a little, you know, you say resting at ease and whatever happens, you could say that's your practice, but, you know, unless you really have this view in a certain way, that can become another stressful demand. I'm supposed to be relaxed now all the time. Then you're imposing another demand upon yourself. Oh, I've got to relax. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
So you have to kind of have this understanding and work with it and contemplate it until it becomes assimilated. But that's also the meaning of, you know, the whole term Dzogchen is that there's this fundamental sense of completion and fullness in a certain way. We usually talk about emptiness in Buddhism, and there, it is empty in that it's not an object, it has no form, but there is a sense of fullness there too, of completion in yourself, just being yourself. So if you can connect with that, then you still have preferences, but the preferences don't have you. You know? Something like that. Yes?
I want to ask something about the assimilating. Because what comes up for me is there's a frustration because I think, understand what you're saying, follow everything what you're saying, and believe in my heart that it's all true, and yet there's been so many years of practice that don't know, it's like when somebody says, well, yeah, I'm assimilated, it's like, I do anything to assimilate it. It's I don't know, it just feels to me like a blessing that's got to come down to me, that just somehow it's completely out of my control. Because I know at moments I have assimilated.
Yeah. Well, you know, the basic way to assimilate this is the basic sadhana, as it's said in this famous text, the 37 practices of the Bodhisattva, which is widely practiced, read and studied in Tibet anyway, is listening, contemplating, and meditating on the teachings. There's really no other way. It helps to be able to meet in groups like this and hear the teachings and discuss them and listen to them and then contemplate them, which means also think about them actually and raise questions and have them answered as well as possible, and then meditate on them. Meditate, then you bring them. Then when you have a clear understanding, and I'm sure you probably do, then you bring that into your meditation and contemplate it. And that's something that could be talked about, how you do that. But basically, just you can remember what you understand and contemplate it. Even if it's take a line from this text or something and use that to begin and then contemplate. That kind of meditation is not talked about that much, you know, among most Buddhists, but it can be helpful to help assimilate. And, you know, I think one of the reasons we have these amazing lamas is who seem to have gone much further than most of us, even though we've been trying for so many years, is they had this opportunity to listen, contemplate, and meditate on the teachings a lot, right? So we don't have to necessarily be in a monastery to do that, but it's good to take the opportunity to do that. Otherwise, you know, if you're trying to force yourself through some technique into a particular state, it just doesn't work that well. That was my experience. And which, by the way, I just want to say something like, it's just a little slightly, I think I pretty much answered your question, but sometimes Rigpa, you know, is translated as awareness. Often it's translated as awareness, which is good. I'm talking about Rigpa as being the fundamental consciousness or awareness or knowingness quality. But when people translate it as awareness, sometimes it can be misleading because people think it's a particular state of mind that you have to get into in meditation. And even some Dzogchen yogis, I think that. That's a conversation I recently had with Anam Thubten, which I'll share with you, you know, about that, where he felt that sometimes even in among the Dzogchen yogis, they are renunciates, they maybe live in caves, and they can spend a lot of time cultivating a kind of state, which can be very beautiful and expansive. But that's not really what Rigpa is. That is a state which can be nice and can even be useful, but it's not a matter of cultivating a particular state of mind. It's a matter of seeing what this nature of the mind is in every state of mind. So that's why am I saying that? I think that's why we don't necessarily have to be monastics or renunciate yogis to understand this. But it does help to, again, to listen, contemplate, and meditate on it. However you can do that, whether it's read this, you know, a lot of people's practice, as much as it is like doing plain, you know, regular sitting or, you know, deity practice or whatever they do, is singing these songs or chanting them or reciting them to themselves to help them to hear these teachings, to contemplate them, and then to meditate on them. That's, I think, how it can be helpful.
some of the great yogis would take this book, Shapkar's Flight of the Garuda, maybe the Choyun Zod by Longchenpa, or a couple of others, one, or so many of them, only two or three texts, and that would be their sadhana, really, primarily, would be to chant, sing, and then contemplate and meditate on those teachings. It's a little bit of a different approach, maybe, than what has often been given in Buddhist circles, but it is a completely bona fide and widely practiced in Tibet and among Tibetans.
You know, I'm looking at this first line, I, the untroubled and carefree renunciate, and then going through and coming to, you know, liberated just by resting in peace and whatever happens.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm coming back to renunciate, and I know it's not, I mean, I know it's symbolic, because he's not just talking about the loincloth in place of the cave, in place of the shelter, and the begging bowl in case of the stock larder, and, you know.
Yeah.
But is it the renunciation of the search of agency? Of the agent, you know, of doing.
Well, ultimately, you
because
could say
just
that.
Just resting at ease in whatever happens, you know. So, really, isn't that what renunciate is referring to here? It's just giving that up in a way?
Well, you could look at it that way, but I think more simply, renunciation, we have associations with that of wearing hair shirts or something like that. But, it really, a better translation for renunciation might be just some basic dispassion, or really what renunciation is
detachment.
Yeah, some detachment, but that can be, then you become, can become a little bit...
disengaged.
Yeah, stiff and disengaged. So what it really means is that when you see really the dissatisfactoriness of this kind of desire template that we impose on the world, which is that if I can only get this or that, I will be happy. When you see, and most of us are old enough to have seen that it never really works, right? Even when we get what we want, we're still not happy. And often what we get gives us more problems that we hadn't even anticipated. And even if it doesn't, the joy and pleasure of it doesn't last very long. It's like the new car smell or something. You know, it only lasts a very limited amount of time. And then we're back to the same old state we've always been in. So at a certain point, you develop a certain dispassion. In other words, where you begin to see that getting what you want or not getting what you want or getting what you don't want, all of those things are not really fundamentally what makes you happy or unhappy. So you develop a certain kind of dispassion for external objects, or you no longer believe that they're going to be the source of your happiness or unhappiness.
But the desire template can also be projected onto the search.
Yeah, it can be.
And the teacher and the practice. Yeah, and it's very subtle, and yet there's also this fire for, you know, the yearning, whatever,
yeah.
that's really important, you know.
That's true.
To keep you alert and attending.
Well, that's why in a certain way the practice, you know, like when we sit, even though we don't really do anything unless we want something from what we're doing. I don't care what anybody says, you don't do anything unless you have a goal. So we sit, and we have a goal in a certain way, but when we sit, we let go of all our goals, and we just sit. So then this kind of awareness can spontaneously arise. Once you actually have this understanding or awareness, then you don't have to seek for it. But not really of the school that says, if you just give up, looking, I mean, it could work. Just give up looking and then you'll have found it. I mean, it sounds good, but...
I guess give up the doing, you know, like the doing, because then I come back to the last line, which is just resting naturally in whatever's happening.
Right.
It doesn't mean giving up attending.
Okay. You
know, paying attention. But
Well, when you have this view, then everything becomes liberated because you can rest. You can actually rest. Because then there really isn't anything to attain. What you are looking for, you see, is actually who you are, and is the nature of the very awareness that you're experiencing right now. So then there's rest in that.
You had a different translation of the text that used a different word than the Nansen. Do you remember what that was?
No.
It was more like rascal or wanderer or something.
Vagabond or something like that? Maybe.
But that's somebody who doesn't have attachments to things, basically.
Yeah.
Which doesn't just mean external.
Well, you know, these yogis, that's what they did. Dispassion, or their sadhana of cultivating dispassion, was to completely give up everything. But it's not absolutely necessary to do that. And most Nyingma practitioners historically really were householders. So, you know, I mean, the reality is, you know, none of this is saying you should never have some concerns or issues or problems in your life at all. On a certain level, you know, if you're a householder, you have children, you worry about your children. If you have a spouse, you worry about your spouse. If you have a job, you may worry about your job, especially in today's economy. But it's on a more fundamental level than this. We are human beings still. But even in the midst of these concerns and worries and things which are natural, it can be a sense of freedom or liberation.
You call it a refuge.
Yeah. Because ultimately it doesn't really, on some level ultimately it doesn't really matter. Things are going to happen as they happen, and it's all fine. There is a fundamental sense of that. It's possible to realize.
It's also liberating that line about can't be impaired, but also can't be improved.
Yeah.
Because I especially think in the West, you know, we're just so addicted to self-improvement. Mm-hmm. And that can really take a very extreme manifestation in, you know, practice in the Dharma context.
No, yeah.
You know, of self-improvement. And that can create so much contraction. Mm-hmm.
That's kind of why I like, you know, meditation practice should be to some extent enjoyable, and it's not just a relaxation technique, but there should be some sense of ease and relaxation in it, and rather than it being a self-improvement project. Okay, we're done. Thank you, everybody.
Thank you.